Thank you all for joining us today, and for those who participated or listened into our panel meeting, thank you for staying with us. We're excited to provide the opportunity today for members of the public to gain an understanding of the CLCPA, how the agriculture and forestry sectors will contribute to meeting New York State's very ambitious climate goals. Your input provided today is welcomed and will bring value to the panel's final set of recommendations to the full Climate Action Council. Everything today will be recorded and considered as our panel works to finalize its recommendations. Next slide, please. The Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act was passed into law in July of 2019. It sets up some very ambitious reductions in greenhouse gas emissions economy-wide. We're looking at a 40% decrease from the 1990 levels by 2030, an 85% decrease from the 1990 levels by 2050, and 100% carbon-free electricity by 2040. It also establishes an overarching goal of carbon neutrality in New York State by 2050. The agriculture and forestry sector and our panel's goals are pretty unique in that they encompass both emissions reductions and carbon sequestration. All the panel recommendations are being made with climate justice and just transitions at top of mind for all of us. Next slide, please. As you can see, we've been very busy since this panel formed in September of 2020, having met 8 times, numerous subgroup meetings held, and cross-panel meetings still happening. This has all been done in order to develop and to deliver a set of agriculture and forestry-related recommendations for consideration and approval by the full Climate Advisory Council, and to be a part of the state scoping plan, which will be the blueprint for how we are going to meet our ambitious goals. The state scoping plan will be drafted and available for public comment early in 2022. With that, I'm going to turn the mic over now to Catherine Morris from CBI, who will be moderating our public engagement session today. Catherine?
Yes, thank you very much, Commissioner Ball. I have been asked to help just manage this public engagement process, in large part because we have about an hour and a half, and we want to make sure that we hear from as many of you as possible. As Commissioner Ball said, this is really a great opportunity for those of you that have been tracking some of these issues, are directly involved in some of these questions, to provide some input to the advisory panel on how to refine their recommendations. So we're going to start by presenting in 5 different topics, sort of where the recommendations are. You got a taste for some of the issues that they have been grappling with over the last several months. And we're going to dig a little bit deeper in these initial presentations and introduce to you topic by topic where they stand and some of the things that they've been thinking about forwarding to the council. We would like to have you at least consider using some of these guiding questions. Which recommendations do you strongly support? And what refinements or additions would you suggest? Again, this is an opportunity for you to help the advisory panel members really fine tune their work over the next month. I understand that many of you will have other things that you want to talk about or other issues you want to bring up that may not go directly to these guiding questions. And certainly we want to hear that. Although I just suggest and encourage you to stay within the lane of the topics that we're talking about. And we'll give you an overview of those topics so that you can hold your questions for or your comments for the point in the discussion that those particular issues are relevant. That said, so the logistics, so the procedural logistics of this are that we would like you to enter your name, your full name, into the Q&A in order to indicate that you would like to speak. And we're going to do our very best to try to take your hands or your indications of speaking in order. That said, we may not be able to take all of the people who want to speak because we did divide this up quite down to the minute in order to give each of the topics equal time and still preserve 10 minutes for public comments. So there's other options. We're going to ask you to limit your comments to 2 minutes, but there are other options for you to indicate what you know, that you're either in agreement with a speaker that's had a chance to go before you in the chat function, and that'll save us some time from just repeating what others have already said. And as Commissioner Ball mentioned, there is going to be the email, agriculture.forestry@agriculture.newyork.gov, is really the best place for you to enter longer, more detailed comments that wouldn't fit into this 2 minute limit that we have today. So I will remind you when we get to the first opportunity for public comments, I hope that you could state your name, your full name when you begin, and your organizational affiliation, or if it's more appropriate, where you reside in New York. And encourage you also to enable your video when you speak. Well, it's certainly not required. So one caveat here is that those of you who have dialed in by phone only are at a bit of a disadvantage. There's not really a way for you to use the chat function or to use the Q&A. If we have extra time at the end, I will certainly use that time to invite those of you on the phone just to speak up, which is the only way we can really get your comments in. I think that's it. As Commissioner Ball said, because we have such limited time, will not be trying to respond to your comments. If you have some clarifying questions, we will ask the speakers to answer very succinctly any clarifying questions from their presentations. But again, I hope that we can spend most of our time on your input on the recommendations or recommendations you would like to see included as the subgroups keep working on this through the next month. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to the first speaker, who is Brian Steinmuller, to first give you the overview of how these topics will be covered, and then from there we'll start in on detail on the first topic.
Thank you so much, Catherine. Next slide, please. Okay, my name is Brian Steinmuller. I'm the Assistant Director for the Division of Land and Water Resources at the Department of Agriculture and Markets and the New York State Soil and Water Conservation Committee. Before going into the detailed recommendations related to agriculture, I just wanted to pause right now and give you a quick broad overview of the multi-sector work and the organization into subgroups that our panel has been able to accomplish thus far. Starting with livestock dairy management, soil health and nutrient management, agroforestry, land conversions, forestry, and the bioeconomy. So I'll talk to you about livestock dairy management, soil health and nutrient management, and agroforestry, and the status of our recommendations thus far. Peter Innes from the DEC Division of Lands and Forests will talk about land conversions and forestry, and Maureen Letty from the DEC Office of Climate Change will talk about the bioeconomy. Next slide, please. Thank you. And before starting off with the specifics on livestock dairy management, I do want to point out that county soil and water conservation districts, Cornell University, Cooperative Extension, USDA, and many others have been doing tremendous work with farms for years on conservation efforts that meet water quality objectives, increase sequestration in soils and new tree plantings, and decrease in greenhouse gas emissions. So the following recommendations really strive to expand on these current efforts and programs while also seeking new opportunities through continued basic and applied research and private-public partnerships to expand financing and incentive options to farms for further implementation of practice systems that reduce and sequester greenhouse gas emissions. So agricultural emissions generally include methane, nitrous oxide, and to a lesser extent, carbon dioxide. The first set of considerations here relate mainly to methane emission reductions on livestock and dairy farms. And again, this is a broad overview, certainly by no means a detailed description. But starting with manure management, The panel here is focusing on reducing methane emissions by implementing cover and flare systems, anaerobic digesters, and other systems that abate, collect, capture, and mitigate methane from manure storages. What we are looking at here is increasing focus for methane reduction through the state's Climate Resilient Farming Program, as well as other state programs, and also seeking pathways for additional private sector financing of on-farm systems. We are also focusing on projects that are ready for implementation now, while engaging in research and innovative approaches to manure management and supporting the implementation of emerging technologies in the long term. Feed management. This is about reducing methane emissions through feed management specifically precision feed management. Doing this through directing planning and implementation funding and conducting and reviewing research on novel approaches, for example, feed additives, as well as advancing information, training, outreach, and technical assistance to livestock producers at various scales. So here we're looking at seeking opportunities to incentivize farms with long records of precision feed management adoption, as well as farms that are in the early adoption stages. Precision feed management in New York State has largely been driven by Cornell University research and extension work, and also market forces, as feed is the largest input cost to dairies and likely will continue as such. So efficiencies gained in feed management not only can reduce methane emissions, but also improve the economic bottom line of the farmer. So I will pause there, Catherine, that is where we are right now with livestock dairy management broadly, and pause for comments.
Great, Brian. You gave us a little extra time here, so we may be able to take a few more extra comments. So again, if you would use the Q&A to enter your full name, and we will unmute you, and as we call on you one by one, and give you an opportunity, 2 minutes, to share your thoughts. It looks like Lynn Bruning is in the queue already. Lynn, would you like to share any comments regarding livestock and dairy management?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good. My comment is actually for forestry management, so I will pause and hold back.
Okay. All right. Thank you. John Patterson, you're up. And again, if you could just say your name and your organization or your where you live, your occupation.
Okay, I'm John Patterson, a dairy farmer from Cayuga County, New York. I wanted to comment about, I'm glad to see the anaerobic digestion as part of the process. I'd encourage the committee to continue looking at anaerobic digestion for carbon reduction along with renewable natural gas production to help the transportation sector reduce their carbon emissions by utilizing renewable natural gas that's produced on upstate dairies and to help reduce the fossil fuels that would be used in the transportation sector. Also allowing for the co-digestion of products to be utilized in, like if the state goes to an LCFS program, I think that California system right now doesn't value the co-digested products the same as it does for raw manure. I think New York State could do a better job, especially seeing how we just had our ban. We have the ban on organics going into the landfill. I think that there's going to be an opportunity there for the state to do a job with this going forward.
Thanks. It's great to hear from people who are going to be either directly implementing or impacted by these recommendations. You have a lot of good on the ground knowledge to share. Do we have any other comments on this topic? Not seeing any names. Let's see if there's anybody on the phone that would like to, I'm not sure, actually, Jake, you might need to correct me, whether we can actually unmute people on the phone. But in the meantime, Nicholas Cantanea is also in line to speak. So Nick, why don't we take you first?
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thank you. My question refers to the feed management. I'm wondering if the legislation will consider upstream agricultural emissions. I look at the Cornell Cooperative Extension Study, and it refers to nutrient balances and imports and exports of contents. But are we talking about how we can better balance those high-intensity agricultural items for replacement? Better suggestion.
Ryan, do you want to try to field this question?
Yes, I can try. It was a little bit choppy, so I'm not sure if I got it all. But I do want to say that precision feed management is something that many dairy farmers have been implementing for years now, and certainly, as I mentioned, the improvement on the economic bottom line. There's also improvements with what we call nutrient mass balance and making sure that the feeding of livestock is being done very efficiently, and that also helps then to balance nutrients as they are applied to the landscape. So our experience with precision feed management thus far has been primarily driven by water quality objectives, and we recognize that there are co-benefits with precision feed management and methane reduction as well. So, we want to capitalize on those co-benefits and, certainly continue to work with farmers to increase efficiency and decrease methane emissions to the extent possible.
Nicholas, did that answer the question for you? You may still be muted, I think. While we're waiting, if you have a follow-up question, we'll take that. But meantime, I'd like to ask Rick Zimmerman if you would, and then he'll be followed by Mike Walcott. So Rick, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to make comments. I work with the dairy industry with regard to renewable energy, and I appreciate the work that's been put into the effort so far by this panel, the Agriculture and Forestry panel, and the subgroup work following that. I strongly support the role of anaerobic digestion as one of the technologies that can successfully achieve the carbon reduction goals that are set forth within the CLCPA. In fact, I think it's one of the most important technologies that the Agriculture and Forestry panel can recommend. I see it as a high return, low cost type of technology, particularly if coupled with a low carbon fuel standard, which is currently being discussed as policy in New York State today. I was glad to hear the discussion about looking at California, because I think California is a great model to closely examine with regard to the role that the low carbon fuel standard has played in their state by creating markets, private market incentives to lower the carbon load in transportation fuels. And it's a win-win in my opinion, and I strongly support that. The other comment I would like to make is that anaerobic digesters on farms in New York State have come a long, long way. And I know that there's been some skepticism and comments made at the Climate Action Council level, doubtful or expressing doubts as to whether digesters can be properly operated on dairy farms in such a way that their success or the effect of pulling carbon from the environment outweighs any sort of unintentional leakage. I think that anaerobic digesters are, and particularly if coupled with a market incentive to sell renewable natural gas, can successfully demonstrate that you can operate those facilities very, very efficiently and very tightly, and that they should be recognized for the high quality work that they've done And I believe that there's some excellent information at Cornell University that demonstrates that fact. So I encourage the panel to look at that breaking information at this point. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Rick. I'm going to move next to Michael Walcott.
Hi there. My name is Michael Walcott. I work at National Fuel Distribution Corporation. And this question, I'm not sure if she's still on here. This question is directed towards Maureen Leddy. I've been kind of following a lot of the presentations from this group from month to month. And Maureen mentioned last time, I'm sorry, did you have something to say?
Well, I was just going to say Maureen will be up again talking about the bioeconomy. Is it specifically on that topic?
Well, it was mainly due to like biofuels. And since we're sort of talking about that as it relates to anaerobic digestion, I kind of came to mind now. I can wait for her if you want, and I could bring up the question at that time.
Catherine, this is Maureen. It's perfectly fine. There's a good deal of crossover between the manure okay. management and that topic.
Okay, sorry. I'll just be a little bit quicker here then. So basically, yeah, Maureen, there seemed to be a bit of a suggestion at the last panel meeting that there was limited potential for biofuels. And I just wondered if maybe you could maybe expand on that just a little bit more.
Sure. So we have looked, you know, we brought in a bunch of experts to help us understand the in-state, the potential feedstocks that we could be generating in-state, right? So if we are managing our, you know, manure through anaerobic digestion, that can potentially reduce methane emissions inside New York State. If that's happening outside New York State, we're not getting that benefit. So we want to really look at what's in state, understanding that there are sources that are out of state that, you know, that's another topic. So when we did look at that and we looked at the potential, and these are by no means definitive numbers. These are like pretty rough estimates, but help us have a reference point to understand that the numbers sort of landed around, you know, even in the best case scenario, we're still in single digits. If you're talking about RNG, with respect to the current levels of consumption of natural gas in the state. So it's not that we can wholly replace all of our natural gas consumption with renewable natural gas. It can only really serve a limited portion. And when we're thinking about in-state production.
Okay. And when you say single digits, you mean as a percentage? Is that
correct?
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So like in between 1% and 9%.
Yeah. I don't have the notes in front of me, but I believe it was 7, something like that.
Okay. Gotcha. And then just one other follow-up question, then I'll stop here. But when you say you brought in experts, is there a specific group that was brought in for that or what do you mean by experts, I guess?
So there was an individual that worked in wastewater that has implemented anaerobic digestion. Well, most wastewater has. So there's from the wastewater sector that have experience with creating biogas from wastewater treatment. And there were folks that are on this panel that are in Cornell looking at not at renewable natural gas, but looking at biomass-based feedstocks. And we also had some additional participants from the waste panel that look at food waste and the potential for anaerobic digestion of food waste. And we did also have one of the Climate Action Council members present on anaerobic digestion for manure management.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Thanks for jumping in, Maureen. I want to keep us on time, so I'm going to go ahead and turn it back to Brian to set up our discussion for the next topic, which is agroforest and soil health. This is a big one, so I want to give you a little bit more time too, Brian.
Yes, thank you very much, Catherine. And
Great, great comments. Thank you so much. So next slide, please. So the next few slides I'm going to take in together, and then we'll pause for comments at the end. So the next area that we are looking at here is agroforestry, which is incorporating trees into areas of agricultural production. This has the potential to reliably increase carbon sequestration and also has many other numerous environmental benefits. We are looking at three main practice systems here with this subtopic. First, forested buffers, which is an area of predominantly trees and or shrubs located adjacent to and upgradient from water courses or water bodies. It also could be something that is planted as shelter belts or windbreaks. And with forested buffers, we do have a lot of experience in implementing those through our existing programs here in New York State. So increasing the implementation of those buffers, but also the establishment, because it's not just an implement and then move on to the next. Certainly these trees and shrubs need a lot of care toward establishment. So we often use those two terms, implementation and then establishment. So getting those buffers established through existing programs, such as our Ag Non-Point Source, which is our water quality program, as well as our climate resilient farming program and our source water buffer program. We're looking at new and innovative types of incentive structures to increase the implementation and adoption of these systems. So structures that could increase income for maintaining these systems in the long term. This could be conservation easements, could also be payments for practices if cropland is taken out of production, for example, and how to help those farmers that lost income. Next, silvopasturing. Silvopasture is the practice of integrating trees, forage, and the grazing of domesticated animals in a mutually beneficial way. And we've heard from experts here, there's not a lot of case studies around the state in silvopasturing, but it is something that is gaining a little bit of steam here. And what we've come to realize is that it builds on the intensively managed rotational grazing acres in New York State. And that is something that there is considerable momentum and a lot of adoption of throughout the state. So using that as kind of a gateway to silvopasturing and incorporating trees into those rotational grazing systems. We know that site selection and species selection are major considerations. So increasing education and technical assistance and support to farmers who are interested in adopting these practices, something that we'd also be recommending. Alley cropping. Alley cropping is carbon sequestration that is gained by planting wide rows of trees with companion crops grown in the alleyways between those rows. This is a relatively unknown practice in New York State, and it may only be applicable to 10% or less of the cropland in New York. Again, not a practice that has been widely adopted thus far. Certainly requires additional education, outreach, technical assistance, as well as field trials, market analysis, farmer-to-farmer interaction in order to increase implementation of these practices. Another way that we can increase implementation of the agroforestry systems as a whole would be to have an agroforestry track through our climate resilient farming program. Certainly agroforestry principles and practices have been proposed and implemented through that program, but for various reasons. So if we were to expand that program, we could also provide more technical and financial assistance to farmers. Next slide, please. Okay. The next one here, we're talking about nutrient management for the explicit purpose of reducing nitrous oxide emissions. Nutrient management, if done to reduce nitrous oxide emissions, also needs to be done while we're achieving the desired crop yields and quality through continued and expanded nutrient management planning and implementation in New York State. And this is applicable to all crop fields, hay fields, pastures, orchards, vineyards, and any agricultural land receiving nutrients. There is considerable momentum here as well, where more and more farmers are operating acres with soil health and nutrient management in mind. And those plans and implementation are improving soil carbon and also helping with ensuring that nutrient management is done in the most effective and efficient way, following the four R's of nutrient management: the right source, right rate, right time, and right place. We're looking at increasing cost share support for technical assistance planning for soil health and nutrient management practices, and also looking to support implementation through the state's agricultural environmental management programs, such as the Climate Resilient Farming Program. Another barrier is equipment, and expanding cost share eligibility in these programs to help farmers gain access to this equipment for more advanced soil health and nutrient management is something that we're looking into as well. Next slide, please. Okay, and I already did talk about soil health a little bit because nutrient management, nitrous oxide emission reductions, nitrogen management go hand in hand with soil health. So here we're talking about increasing carbon sequestration with the adoption of soil health management practices. Some of those practices could be cover crops or double crops, conservation tillage practices, and again, managed grazing practices to increase and elevate soil health. The panel is focusing on increasing current efforts while also exploring innovative incentive options to increase adoption. And adoption is underlined there because that is incredibly important. It's not just about the implementation of these practices, but also trying to incentivize and work with farmers to adopt these practices in the long run. So it becomes a part of their management moving forward, regardless of program access. We're looking at increasing technical assistance and outreach, providing a flexible soil health program policy that encourages the stacking or comprehensive systems approach following the four soil health principles outlined here as well, maximizing continuous living roots in the soil, minimizing disturbance, maximizing soil cover, and maximizing biodiversity. We talked about a support for equipment, the same is needed here as well, especially for some smaller farms in need of specialized equipment in order to invest in soil health practices. We've also talked about payment for ecosystem services as an innovative incentive approach that is more outcome-driven rather than individually practice-driven. Another very important key to this, and we talked about it earlier, and probably key to all of our advisory panel recommendations, is continuing to further advance measurement and quantification of our benefits. We know that soil health has multiple environmental benefits, but the measuring and quantification of soil carbon is much more difficult, and it certainly takes a steady investment to do that over time. And also the advancement of research for perennial agriculture, where we're able to take annual cropland, convert that into some perennial system, certainly also has soil health benefits. Next slide, please.
So, Brian, just in the interest of time, you might want to hit sort of the high points in the next couple of slides.
Thank you so much. I will definitely do that. I think I already hit on a few of them. Thank you. So all of our conservation practice systems that we talked about here today also improve efficiency and can reduce fossil fuel inputs. So we want to capitalize on that and continue to track that over time as well. Next slide. And I already hit on a few of these initiatives that can support these strategies. So a couple that I just want to emphasize is increasing technical assistance, expanding technical service capacity to aid farm planning, implementation, and operation of practices. And also modifying our AIM planning framework to explicitly plan for climate mitigation and adaptation so we can provide a carbon footprint for a farm and prescribe practices that can reduce that footprint. Ongoing research and outreach, needing to implement and expand that to guide current efforts, but also emerging practices toward the highest possible impact. And I already talked about payments for ecosystem services, so I will pause there. Or any comment.
Thanks, Brian. We do have folks lining up. Simon Gruber, you're up first. Do we have Simon unmuted? You could just say your name and your affiliation. We may have lost him. So others, and for anybody who's been joined late in this process, in this conversation, please indicate that you would like to say something by putting your name into the Q&A, and we'll call on you. give us 30 more seconds if anybody wants to say something. I realized we can't really take folks on the phone without unmuting everybody, and that's pretty dangerous. But if no one else has anything to comment on this set of topics, Lynn Bruning.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, good. Thank you so much. I'm Lynn Bruning. I'm a concerned citizen and the fifth generation in the town of Duanesburg in Schenectady County. What I'm wondering today is, does the state have a spreadsheet that documents how many acres of mature forest are clear cut and prime agricultural land that is converted for the construction of solar wind energy resources? If we're considering the benefits of solar and wind, we should also be accounting for the loss of the carbon sequestration in our forests and the loss of the food production on our lands. If there is such a spreadsheet, I'd love to be able to view that. Can the state regulate clear cutting of parcels prior to submission of solar and wind applications? Being in rural New York and knowing many people involved with solar, it has become painfully aware to me that developers and landowners may go and clear cut their parcels prior to submitting their applications. And this allows them to avoid local regulations restricting how much forest can be clear cut. How could that matrix also be captured so that we truly understand how much land and forest we are losing to solar and wind? And I'd like to thank John Bartow for mentioning that the out-of-state power purchase agreements do not assist the state in reaching the governor's ambitious energy goals. These intermittent energy resources take New York State taxpayer money and land. The Article 10 projects occupy our Department of Public Service judges' time. And the distributed energy resource facilities, which are marketed to many rural unsuspecting towns with the misleading name of community solar, overburden small town volunteer planning boards. Is spending taxpayer money on these projects that may be selling their electricity to Connecticut and other states equitable to the abutting landowners and the host communities? So thank you very much. And I'd also like to say that I listened to a lot of the different panel's meetings, and I enjoy the agriculture one the most. Chairman Ball does a great job. Thanks.
So your two questions at the top, Brian, if you want to respond, one regarding the tracking of forest and ag land conversion for the purposes of siting solar projects and the greenhouse gas emission trade-offs with that. Or Brian, maybe you want to pass this off to somebody else. I'm not sure. Brian, you're muted if you are trying to respond. There you go.
Thank you. Yes, now I am. Thank you so much. I don't have the answer to those questions right now, but I would encourage Lynn to use the email address and can certainly provide her comments and her questions that way, and we'll do our best to respond.
Okay, so I don't think that we have anybody else in the queue at this point. So let's move to our next topic. And I believe we're going to hand this off to Peter.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you. So this is Peter Ennis. I'm the Assistant Director of Lands and Forests for DEC. And kind of commenting on Lynn's question, we do not track forest management activities in New York State at any kind of parcel level. There are no statewide regulations for timber harvesting, so there's no method for us to track any of that conversion that occurs. Some of the information I'll get into on conversions is more on a statewide basis that's developed through inventory that the U.S. Forest Service does on a periodic basis. So trying to answer that question ahead of time. So for kind of the forestry side of things, so to speak, and the ag and forestry considerations, we're going to talk about three different topics quickly. And so one is, you know, they're pretty simple. In essence, forest lands are important. So our sector in particular is really concentrating on sequestration. So we know that woods and forest land sequester lots of carbon. About 2 billion tons of carbon are stored in New York's forests. So we want to keep forests as forests. We have about 18.6 million acres of forest land, which has actually been slightly decreasing for the last 20 years or so. There was a rapid increase of forest land in the 20th century, and it's plateaued and is probably starting. Data suggests that it's starting to decrease very slightly, probably in order of only 1 or 2%. Then another avenue to increase sequestration on our forest land is to improve the management that occurs on those forests. So we'll briefly talk about that. And then we'll talk about afforestation and reforestation, including urban forestry components. So it's kind of, again, simple. Plant more trees in both the urban and rural and urban environment. So next slide, please. So we'll take questions at the end of these three slides. So the first one up will be looking at forest management and trying to improve forest management practices. We know that regeneration is an issue in much of New York State. And what I mean by regeneration is generally in New York and frankly in the Northeast in general, the natural succession of a forest is natural or done. Nature does a better job than we can. So in the South and in some places in the West, there's a lot of replanting that occurs. But in the Northeast, nature does a much better job than us in trying to replant or revegetate that forest land. So it's a perpetual forest if we manage it correctly. So we know that in New York, we have our regeneration is not at 100% in much of our areas. And it's really focusing on two main issues, various competing vegetation, whether it be actually invasive or native competing vegetation, and also over-browsing by deer. They really like forest seedlings, particularly forest hardwood seedlings. And so that's an issue that we're looking at as a panel. So we have to try to increase that natural regeneration that occurs to ensure that the next forest is there in the next 20, 50, and 100 years. New York was about 25% forested at the turn of the century, and it's now a little over 60, about varies, 62, 63%. At one point in time, as I said, we were up around 64%, and it's just decreased slightly. The other thing is to improve the management of our forest lands when we conduct timber harvesting operations. So the slide indicates that what we really want to do is try to avoid high grading, which is a term used to indicate that just the best trees are taken out, leaving, in essence, smaller and potentially inferior trees. So if we can use the principles of forestry and forest management, we can increase the amount of sequestration that can occur on our forest lands. So the panel has been looking at a variety of things. We're focused on private land because 75% of New York's forest land is owned by private landowners. So that's where the real scaling effect can occur, where we can increase that carbon sequestration. We're looking at different options New York has a forest tax law program. It's a reduction in people's real property taxes. It's known as Real Property Tax Law 480A. You'll notice here on the slide that it talks about a new track called 480C. So is there a potential to create a new real property tax break for landowners to incentivize them keeping it? We'll bring this up again in the avoided conversion, but when you have that real property tax break, there's certain obligations. So we initially then improve forest management because they are getting a tax break in essence. We're looking at trying to team up with Ag and Markets on their AEM program. So let's try to include a forest carbon option, increase the level. The agricultural sector in New York owns a lot of forest land, and so let's try to utilize that. I'm going to get a common theme here is kind of we need to do a lot of different things, kind of all hands on deck, to try to increase fairly dramatically the sequestration that occurs in New York's forest. Again, we talked a little bit about expanded regeneration and what the challenges of that are. So are there incentives? Can we utilize some cost share programs to try to get landowners to adopt some of those practices to control invasive species or to control deer browse through a variety of methods? We're looking at programs. There is no licensing requirement of foresters in New York State, but we're looking at potential certification or carbon certification for foresters. So if a landowner signs up under 480C and has a forest management plan, would have to be prepared by a forester that's been trained and certified by New York State. So that's one of the avenues we're looking at. We're also looking at different other incentives for smaller forest landowners and trying, again, improve their forest management opportunities out there. That means a lot of outreach and education. There's 700,000 forest landowners in New York. About half of those own more than 10 acres, which would be we concentrate at least initially. And we're also looking at about trying to increase. So there's two aspects. One is we obviously need to keep the existing carbon there, and we need to increase the amount, so the additionality that will occur. And we also can't lose track of the fact that our forest lands offer a tremendous amount of co-benefits, from providing raw materials for forest industry, healthy air, improved water quality, wildlife habitat, those sort of things. So that's where we are with that portion. And I would turn it back to Catherine for questions.
Great. All right. Good timing. So let's see. Anyone have any follow-up refinements, endorsements, some additions that you would like to see the advisory panel and this subgroup take on? Hugh Canham?
Yeah.
Yes. If you could just tell us your name and your affiliation, that'd be great.
Can you hear me now?
You can.
Okay. I'm Hugh Canham. I'm retired professor of forest and resource economics at the College of Environmental Science and Forestry in Syracuse. I have looked at forest landowners and studied them and done a lot of study and work with them for, I was just looking here, for I would say 58 years. And the things that have been advocated by the advisory panel, I have sat in and listened to, I think, all of the advisory panel meetings. I have some longer comments. Peter, I don't know if you've seen them. I sent them originally to John Bartow, Bob Momsheimer, Tom Giroux. I will send these to the agriculture.forestry email page. But two things that I think we should concentrate on. One is the idea of property taxes. Property taxes and forestry have been talked about here in New York State for all of the 58 years that I've been a professional here in the state. If we're going to have something, and I think the 480C is a very, very good idea, but it's got to be simple. It's got to be simple. One of the problems with 480A is it was very involved. I say was because if it were simpler, more people would sign up. I don't think in 480C, and I'm happy to see that there is a no harvest track. We don't need to have people harvest these small tracts. What we want them to do is keep it in forest land. And that's the key. Now, for that, you give them a property tax break. And if they decide to convert their acreage to a home site or something else that's not a forest, there's a rollback penalty. Okay. Now, the problem with that whole 480A, 480C, or agricultural exemptions is somebody else in the community has got to pay the tab, or else it's got to be paid at the state level. And assessors don't like some of the complications that go with it. And local governments don't like to push the taxes on somebody else.
So, Hugh, just a time check. We're at
okay, I'm
2 minutes, but I'll give you an extra 15 seconds if you want to make another point.
That I think in the long run, we should look at getting local governments away from complete reliance on the property tax. We'll never get rid of it in New York State, but we need to think of other ways of tapping incomes and ability to pay. The other thing that I just want to stress here under the forest and forest management is the at the time of harvest, I think is when we can make the biggest bang. And I like the idea of saying that anybody that wants to do a timber harvest can go ahead and do it. But if you want to get some sort of a tax break, then yes, let's have a certified forester help in conducting the sale. That's where we make the biggest bang, rather than in timber stand improvements good, but marketing and harvesting is the best. Thank you.
And thank you. It's a lot of good detailed considerations for this subgroup. Do we have any other comments before we move to the next topic? John Dickinson?
John Dickinson, dairy farmer and chairman of Northeast Dairy Producers Association. Is there any work or any comparisons done to the carbon sequestration capacities of different land uses, i.e. cropping, cornfield, intensively hay fields, vegetable farms, and for compares to forest and properly managed forest? I would think that a properly managed forest where there's new fresh regrowth has got to have a greater capacity to sequester carbon than a mature, unharvested land tract, as is agriculturally utilized lands. Is there any efforts being made to quantify capacities? To either Brian or this gentleman.
I'll let Brian cover some of it. This is Peter again. That's one of the things the panel is looking at. There's a variety of studies out there that address that issue. of the amount of, there's two aspects. One is the carbon storage aspect, and then there's the carbon sequestration or the rate per year. And so there's a variety of studies that we're looking at. And so that's part of, certainly a major part of our recommendations. We have to take that into consideration. So those are some questions that we're still kind of debating, not debating, but researching.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks, John, for your question. On the soil carbon or the ag side, there's been some research that we've looked at recently in a presentation given by the Cornell Soil Health Program that characterizes soil carbon capability within various sectors of agriculture, different cropping styles, together with the inherent soil properties of that cropping, of what's happening there. And that's what's allowed us to kind of look at the soil health characterization and, you know, judge what kind of additional soil carbon or sequestration is possible in, you know, the broad view of different management, whether it's processed vegetables or annual grains, you know, cash crop, pasture, and so forth. So taken together with the actual soil properties themselves, it gives us a bit of a, you know, good understanding of what's possible out there from a soil carbon standpoint. So our panel has been looking at that research to try to get an idea of what can be done on the agricultural side.
Thanks, Brian. At this point, I'll turn it back to Peter, and we'll move on to the topic of land conversions. We're staying right on time. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you. The this one, actually, we're going to do a little bit, backwards, I guess. We're going to talk about reforestation and afforestation issues. Another topic to plant trees. So we know that if we can increase the amount of forest land in New York, we'll increase the amount of carbon sequestration and carbon storage that occurs. The estimates are that there are literally between 1.7 and this says 2.4 million acres. It might even be as high as about 4 million acres of theoretical lands that could be planted. What's the practical aspect of that? It's probably a fraction of that. Is it, you know, and that's more research that needs to be done. Is it 10% of that figure, or is it 25 or 50% of that figure? We do know that replanting the afforestation of abandoned fields or marginal cropland is a very expensive process. It's several hundred dollars per acre at minimum, and can actually more likely approach $1,000 per acre when you start looking at tending those new plantings. So it's a very expensive avenue, but it is one that we are looking at because of the decrease in forest land and the fact that, again, we need to sequester much more carbon in New York State to try to meet our net zero goal by 2050. So the, you know, how would we do that? Obviously, incentives are one way to do it. We could target, again, working through the AEM program in Ag and Markets, this underutilized or marginal farmland. We got obviously other rural lands that are available for planting, and it takes a very information and education outreach program to meet those and inform those landowners of those opportunities. But it's likely going to take an incentive program to really scale up any kind of major replanting efforts. There's lots of different challenges between protecting those seedlings, preparing the planting areas correctly, the production of seedlings, the acquisition of them, whether or not you are concentrating on hardwoods, which are very expensive to plant, usually you have to protect those, or softwoods. So there's a lot of questions out there, but in general, we know that we want to enhance the amount of afforestation in New York. Reforestation is trying to increase the tree cover that's in our current forest lands that are underutilized or understocked and that don't have the proper density of forest of trees in them, lower than what the land can handle, so to speak, or the capacity of the land. So, again, that can be a very expensive proposition when you're, New York is mostly a hardwood state. When you're trying to underplant hardwoods, you have to protect them from a variety of things, mostly deer browse, so tree tubes, that sort of thing. But those are options that we're looking as we begin to expand New York's forest lands and try to reverse that trend of that's been happening over the last decade or two. We also know that we need to increase the amount of tree canopy we have in our cities. We get a lot of co-benefits from that, from the heat island effect and obviously health benefits for particularly clean air. So, you know, there's different avenues that we can look at it there. We can increase subsidies to communities, grant programs. We currently have a grant program, New York State DEC does, to help communities both in their management of their lands, you know, tree inventories, writing management plans, and then in the actual planting of additional street and park trees. We also have to remember that we have to maintain what we plant. You know, if a street tree averages only with poor maintenance 3, 4, 7 years, and we can triple that by maintaining it, we've gained a lot of useful both sequestration and but those other co-benefits in urban forestry, which are really important and key. And again, we can target those underutilized, or not underutilized, underserved and disadvantaged communities, the communities that are now, you know, those heat island effect, the ones that are really have a shortage or a deficit of tree canopy cover. So there's a variety of methods we can utilize for that, but grants are probably the principal way that we can move forward with that program. New York State has a New York Relief Program where we bring together technical assistance and we provide grants and information to both municipal and volunteer groups at the local level in communities and cities. So I'd be happy to take questions on the general topic of tree planting, both rural and urban.
Well, given the time that we have left for the last two topics, would it be possible for you to go ahead and continue through the land conversion, then we'll take some comments?
Sure, that's no problem.
Okay, great.
The land conversion, that'd be the next slide. The harvested wood products is an important aspect that is part of this group, but it's really going to be addressed in the bioeconomy. But we know that there are various benefits from harvested wood products. So I'm going to skip that one and we'll go to the next slide. So most of these things we've covered, so to speak. We want to, as Dr. Canham mentioned, you know, property taxes are one of the biggest deterrents to landowners for holding on to forest land. Property taxes are significant all across New York and much more so in certain areas. So can we modify the current tax law 480A to have a carbon component, so to speak? Can we create this new 480C program? Can we look at other tax credit options for landowners that have forest land? So instead of having to reimburse local governments or having local governments wishing they had greater reimbursement for this state mandated program, is there a way that we could do a tax credit? So those are things that are being looked at, investigated. Can we conserve more land through both easements and through fee acquisition? So procurement of land by both municipal and state governments, nonprofit groups. New York has a very robust land trust organizations, I think over 80 different land trusts in New York State that protect lands through both easement and fee acquisition. So those are some of the topics that the avoided conversions are really concentrating on at this point in time. So happy to get your comments on those two topics together. Thank you, Kathleen. Catherine.
Yes, we have, again, Nicholas Catania. Did you have a comment, a follow-up comment?
Yes, hi. Thank you. I'd like some consideration to be made to what are the harvesting cycles for these intended forestry lands and what their end uses might be, whether it is for things like home building, which is going to preserve the wood, or if it's a fact for bioenergy. Because in effect, we're talking about this carbon sequestration, and once it is utilized for that next purpose, it's released back into the atmosphere. And if we're trying to correspond with our climate mitigation timeline over the next 30 to 100 years, we should compare that to what our emission curves are going to be over that, so that we know we're going to be harvesting these in 20 years, that it's not competing with those methane emissions that are those short-term gases, but in fact aren't going to have the same effect 100 years out, the same as harvesting that tree over a much longer time span.
So this is really a recommendation about an analysis that would could be done to support the recommendations. Is that right?
Yes, it's referring to being more specific on the type of forestry and type of sequestration that's intended here, so that we are enhancing the intent of the Climate Act.
Great, thank you. Other comments on forest management, afforestation, reforestation, and then this land conversion question or voided conversion? Okay, seeing no one in the queue, I'm going to turn it over to Maureen Leddy for wrapping this up on the bioeconomy topic.
Thanks so much, Catherine. So the bioeconomy subgroup of the Forest Agriculture and Forestry Advisory Panel has been looking at what we are calling a climate-focused bioeconomy. So it's the portion of the economy that produces sustainable and renewable bio-based products to replace fossil-intensive or fossil-based products. And that can mean lots of things, so we're narrowing our focus around the way that we can position the bioeconomy to achieve the climate and social justice goals of the CLCPA. The group has talked a lot about maintaining and enhancing the bioeconomy supply chains within the state of New York so that when future market opportunities arise, we're positioned to take advantage of them. And to look at policies that achieve the CLCPA requirements, you know, it's foundational in building out this sector. We are looking at, we can go to the next slide, please. There's three main areas of focus that the bioeconomy subgroup has been thinking about. And one is substitution of bio-based products. And the previous comment sort of is to this point of where we can advance policies, code changes, break down barriers to increase the use of wood products in buildings, to increase the use of bioplastics, how we can advance all of our low-carbon products that the state of New York currently does make through connecting, you know, buyers and sellers. So that's, you know, that's increasing sequestration by having long-lived products in buildings and other applications. We're also looking at bioenergy, and the group has had a discussion around the potential bioenergy resource within the state, looking at various different feedstocks, and what are the emissions reductions opportunities associated with them. And we've also had discussions with other advisory panels on end-use applications for bioenergy, trying to, you know, to understand the highest and best use for bioenergy. And the bioenergy component of our conversation focuses on understanding the co-pollutants and the land use considerations of bioenergy, addressing that it's a complicated topic for which there are lots of nuanced issues that need to be addressed. The group is also interested in building out the concept of a biorefinery, which is using bio-based feedstocks to replace things, petrochemicals, things that fossil fuels are used to create today. And we see this as more of a real future-looking R&D investment opportunity within the scoping plan. To some of the other subgroups, discussions around things that we can do today versus in the middle term versus looking out into the long term. So if we put policies in place today that protect our supply chains when, you know, biorefining or bio-based petrochemical, you know, bio-based chemicals and pharmaceuticals, New York will be positioned to be a market leader in those spaces. So that's what we have been looking at, and I'm happy to receive comments on the work.
So, again, if there's someone who wants to either ask a clarifying question or comment on refinements or additions to what this subgroup has been looking at, please just enter your name in the Q&A. Don't be shy. There we go. Ann Erling?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, okay. I actually I had a couple of questions. First, I had to step away, so I'm not sure if you mentioned this, but I'm wondering to what extent you're looking into biochar. I see you have a lot of, on this slide, you mentioned a lot of other bio-based products. But biochar and also using those that biomass simply to sequester carbon, even producing biofuels and just injecting it into the ground as a carbon sequestration technology. I'm wondering to what extent you're looking at that, and also to what extent you're looking at fertilizer and pesticide restrictions or rules, because fertilizers and pesticides applied to the ground negatively affect the soil biome, so which affects the ability to sequester carbon. So this would apply to towns as well as agricultural land.
Sure. I can tackle the biochar question. But I don't think I have much to add on your second question. So the topic of biochar has come up. There's a lot of work out there, a lot of academic work for sure on it, and there's some demonstration projects in New York as well. We haven't dug too deep into applications of biochar, but it is something that has been raised just kind of in our recent discussions. So I think it's something that we will kind of thinking a little bit more about.
And Anne, your second question goes back to nutrient management. Sounds like more broadly than just agriculture, which we did talk about that, and soil health practices generally on agriculture. Are you asking more broadly about residential use of nutrients and other applications beyond agriculture?
Still hear me? I'm interested in fertilizer, pesticide, possibly fertilizer, pesticide bans in towns. Working with golf courses, also. I think we have a lot of land in this state, in addition to farmland, that could be brought into the carbon sequestration effort.
Brian, you want to take this one?
Yes, hi. I can try to address the pesticide and fertilizer question on agricultural lands. And just to go back to the soil health recommendations that I presented on a little earlier, you know, we're looking at a suite of practices and ways that we can increase and boost soil health for a myriad of reasons. And here we're focused on soil carbon. So understanding the relationships between fertilizer use, pesticide use, and soil carbon is certainly something that we'll continue to look at and work on and try to, you know, really tailor a plan for a farmer who is interested in increasing soil health on their farm and doing so in a way that encompasses their management and, you know, what their objectives are, while also, you know, making sure that, you know, the plan is prescribing practices that can increase soil carbon. So, you know, looking at how fertilizer and pesticide use all plays into that would be something that we'd tailor into an individual farm plan for soil health.
And Brian, do you know if the local government land use group might be taking up the question of applications more broadly for, you know, within a town? Or is that something that, you know, it doesn't fall really within anybody's scope?
I'm not sure about the scope for the CLCPA, but could also be a question broadly for DEC to answer on how you know, that is looked at on more of the municipal level.
Yeah, this is Maureen. I'll jump in. I know that the Land Use and Local Government Panel is looking at ways that local governments can advance sequestration, but I don't know if they're looking at this specific angle on sequestration.
Well, thank you, Anne, for bringing that up. And I'll just see if there's any other comments on this topic. And if not, I'll open it up more broadly for just general comments, as we have a few minutes left. Okay, well, since we have about 5 minutes remaining for this portion of the public comment, I just want to allow those opportunity for those who had other comments regarding generally the Ag and Forestry Advisory Panel recommendations or the topics that they have been covering to take this last 5 minutes. And I would just ask that you keep your comments to 2 minutes each, but that give us a chance to take at least two or three more comments. And if not, we will give those 5 minutes back to everybody for the rest of their afternoon. But I can turn it over here for closing to Commissioner Ball.
Well, thank you so much, Catherine. And you can see on the slide here that our panel will meet twice in March. As usual, those panels will be available for the public to listen in as well. I just want to say a very sincere thanks for your participation today and also your patience. I want to thank our presenters from both DEC and Ag and Markets, Brian Steinmuller, Peter Ennis, Maureen Luddy, great job. And a special thanks to you, Catherine, for facilitating and keeping us on track this afternoon. I know I heard many well thought out comments. Rest assured they have been recorded and will be shared with the panel. I have to add that it's been very rewarding for me to work with this Ag and Forestry panel. I think you can see with this opportunity today that they are considering a pretty wide range of subjects in a very thoughtful way. There's a lot of very good minds around this virtual table working very hard to achieve our goal here. This is the only scheduled public engagement session, so those of you who did not have an opportunity to provide verbal comments today, or if you have a longer form thought or comment you'd like to make, please use the dedicated email address on the screen that's coming up right now, and your comments will be accepted, reviewed, and considered as we continue the panel's work. So again, thanks so much for this opportunity for us today. Hope it was helpful, and we appreciate your input. Thanks so much.